This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
In the next 10 years, more than 80% of the global oil production growth comes from the United States only. As such, we believe there will be a lot of oil in the markets and will put downward pressure on the prices.
And a big hearty welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and early happy Thanksgiving to everybody, which is coming up later on in the week. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. The clip was the voice of Faith Burrell, and the International Energy Agency is out with its annual energy report. And one of the things that it makes very, very clear is that the age of oil is anything but over. However, energy is going through a transition right now, and it's very clear that our world will be powered very differently by 2040. So what we're going to do here today in the first part of the big picture is to cover the main points of this report. First of all, to examine the industry and the changes going on, and of course, what this means for investment opportunities.
You know, John, as I was looking at the report and reading it, one of the key things that really stands out is the word upheaval. And that's certainly what's taking place in the energy sector today. I mean, just take a look at what we've seen in the last 3 or 4 years. We've seen the price of oil come down from $100 a barrel down to $26 a barrel. We've seen the U.S. take the lead in energy production. As Faith Burrell just talked about, a good majority of the increase of oil production around the globe is coming out of the U.S. Who would have ever thought of this 6, 7, or 8 years ago? But when I say the word upheaval, it's taking place on many fronts. One, the U.S. is turning into the undisputed leader for oil and gas. Just take a look at the impact that we had on bringing the price of oil down from over $100 a barrel. Number two, solar photovoltaics is on track to become a major source of energy. And number three, like it did in the last decade, China's new drive towards clean energy is recasting the country's influence on the energy market. So China is still a major factor, but in a different way, as we'll discuss as we get into this big picture. And finally, number four, the future is electrifying, spurred by cooling, electric vehicles, and digitalization. And we're going to see that, and we'll talk about it a little bit more. But certainly the age of the electric car is upon us, and not too shortly, the self-driving car will be here as well.
And if you'd like to see some self-driving cars, all you have to do is see cars being driven by people who were trying to text and drive. You know, the car's driving. The car's trying to drive itself.
I don't know. This is kind of off the wall, but it just kind of reminds me. The other day, I'm sitting there at the stoplight. There's a gal in front of me in this SUV. Light turns green, and she's not moving. And then, you know, finally, after about 20, 30 seconds, I honked the horn, and I won't tell about the hand sign I got. But by the time she gets through, John, the light's yellow. I mean, it's just like, hey, I got an important text, and I'm not moving until I do it. But that's not what we're talking about.
No, it isn't indeed. Speaking of things, it sounds like the energy markets, though, Jim, are really changing in rather profound ways, which I would think has profound investment implications as well.
Well, very big implications for investing in the future in terms of what industries lead, what's going to happen to the energy companies, the big behemoths, the big oil companies, and also the exploration companies. But, you know, one of the things that really strikes me about this is China, once again, is going to have an influence, but more so in different ways, more in the renewable sector than it is on, let's say, oil consumption. When it comes to oil consumption, India takes the lead in terms of new net energy demand, surpassing China, according to the IEA, in the next decade.
You know, China has really major pollution problems and as such is moving towards renewables. It doesn't mean it's going to be there at any time in the near future. But remember the problem they had with the Olympics and the air quality.
Yeah, what really stands out, if you look at how energy consumption has changed since 1990 and going forward, they had some statistics in terms of what we were using to power our economy in 1990, where we are today, and where we're likely to be in the year 2040. Coal and oil demand decreased dramatically over the next two decades, while demand accelerates for renewables and natural gas. And that is going to be a big, big factor in the energy energy sector. In fact, there have been a lot of major acquisitions, one by Royal Dutch, one by Exxon, to acquire natural gas companies because they see this as a growing fuel source, and especially as a lot of power plants being built here today. We're building natural gas power plants to keep emissions down, pollution down, all those kind of things. The same thing is happening overseas and is going to happen even in a bigger way when you take a look at Asia and India, which has the world's largest population. I mean, half the world is probably in Asia, in India. So from an investment point of view, renewables and natural gas are going to be the key energy drivers going forward. And just to give you a perspective on that, both fuels, renewables and natural gas, account for nearly 85% in the increase in global demand for energy. So it just goes to show you how the energy mix is changing globally around the world. It's not just here in the U.S., it's going to be mainly in Asia. The other thing that really strikes me about this is behind these dramatic fuel shifts is China. And as everybody saw in the last decade, as you saw commodity prices rise, we saw oil prices spike as well before technology came into the oil sector with horizontal drilling and shale and fracking, which changed the whole energy mix and gave birth to tight oil, which is what's driving a lot of the U.S. oil production. But just as China's demand for energy, as they industrialize their economy, as cars become more predominant, you know, they've gone from bicycles to motor scooters to now automobiles, once again, like they did in the last decade, China is moving the energy markets again. Its most visible effect is on coal and oil and on, let's say, renewables. And that's one of the things that the IEA is taking a look at. It's going to be amazing because I know one of the things that President Trump ran on is revitalizing coal. But in itself, coal is a dying industry and actually a negative consumption over the next two decades as China turns more and more of its coal-fired plants to natural gas and renewables. That's going to put downward demand on coal. So coal, in a sense, is a dying industry. Also, oil consumption will be much, much less as a result of China and also what's happening not only in Europe, but it's also happening in developing countries like Japan, the U.S. But what is really growing probably the fastest is going to be renewables, and especially solar and wind, which was surprising. I thought you might have seen nuclear power, but with the events of Fukushima back in 2011, nuclear power demand is receding, and it's being replaced by renewables. The other thing, too, that comes out here is China is switching to a new economic model, which emphasizes clean energy. John, you alluded to earlier the pollution in a lot of the big cities in China. China has more cities with populations over a million people in them. And just as you mentioned, during the Olympics, they had to shut down the city for almost 6 months just to clean out the air so people could breathe. So they are dealing with major health hazards due to pollution. So their switch is going to drive global energy trends. And that is going to be a big factor behind renewables. And it's like anything else, as more technology, more research comes into the area, is more use, it's bringing down the cost. Everything from solar panels all the way down to batteries. And batteries are going to be a real key factor going forward, especially when you take a look at solar power. I don't know what it's like where you live, John, but I would say in my neighborhood, more than half the homes are powered by solar panels. Now, part of that is energy production here and energy costs are very, very expensive in California. We've closed down two of our nuclear power plants. We've decommissioned them and we're not building enough plants. And so California is trying to move more towards renewables, more on the solar front because we get so much sunshine here, which is surprising because California has one of the longest coastlines in the country. And I'm surprised wind is not as prominent as it is in Europe, given our shorelines.
Well, I've noticed, Jim, even in the North Country here, in places you wouldn't think, especially where there is less sunlight over the course of a year, people are still moving to putting in solar because some of the new technologies are allowing solar generation even on cloudy days and related things like that. So there is a move to try to offset the cost of energy and to recoup some of it.
You know, it's amazing because when I think of solar, I don't think of, John, where you live, where, I mean, what do you get, snow about 3 or 4 months out of the year? But you know what? It's still working and it's still a viable alternative. But I think probably in the colder areas or regions of the country, even though you might see the introduction of solar, you're probably going to see more energy produced from natural gas.
Yeah. And of course, in the Pacific Northwest, like, we heat with electricity here as one of our sources. And that's because it is so cheap due to hydroelectric energy, which is renewable. I mean, it counts as one of those because it's non-polluting and it's constantly renewing. Now, but when we're talking about renewables, is the demand for this an actual global phenomenon, or is it really something that's regional, driven more by what, the local environment or local politics?
No, according to the IEA, this is a global-driven trend, mainly by three countries. China, India, and the U.S. take the lead, especially in solar, while Europe's lead is more on and offshore wind. And once again, it's something that I wonder if California eventually moves in that direction, because we have such a large shoreline. We're ideally set up for wind production as well, and that may be something we see in our future. But renewables require more flexibility to match power demand and supply, because one of the problems that you have with solar and with wind, it is intermittent power. If you don't get sunshine, well, guess what? You're not producing power. If you don't have wind, you're not producing power. So I think a key part of this is going to be backup power, like, for example, battery storage technology. It's one of the things that we're looking at next here on our home, is putting in large battery backups for our solar system, because a lot of these units are coming out. Tesla's got one that's coming out. There's a German company that has one. So a lot of the storage and battery technology is one reason why solar is becoming more predominant. But when we take a look at renewables, it's just not just these three countries. I mean, obviously, China, the U.S., and India become the biggest generators of electricity in the next two decades. And, you know, it really struck me from an investment point of view when some of the analysts we've had on the program have commented on this. It may explain why utilities are doing as well as they have done so far this year. I mean, when you think about it, utility average is keeping right up there with the Dow and the S&P on a price basis. Utilities are up 16% for the year, and that's not counting the 3-4% dividends you get in utilities. So if this trend continues, utilities could pull in a 20% rate of return for investors. And I think that reflects in many ways, John, not just yield, because investors are still shopping the globe for that. In fact, our technician this week, Dave Nikoski, was commenting that one of the things that strikes him as strange in this market rally this year has been not only that, you know, the S&P and the Dow's up, technology, but also utilities are right up there with technology, industrials, and other sectors. And that's something typically you don't see. And I think this reflects the electrification of the country and where we're going with all this technology. You're talking about electric cars. You know, I have an electric car. What does that mean? At night, I'm plugging in the charger into my car, so I'm using electricity. Think of all the devices that we have today, from our smartphones to our laptops to our iPads. All these devices, computers, high-level entertainment that we have in our home today, all of that we're using as consumers more and more electricity. Well, who supplies that electricity? The utilities. So in many ways, utilities are once again becoming growth companies.
Now, let's go to electric cars, because as you watch them right now, the technology is such that you can drive them around for relatively short distances in town, like for running errands. The problem is in colder climates where you need heat in the car as well. And of course, heat's a huge consumer of battery output, so that's not going to be as feasible as you might think. But I'm assuming the technology will get better. But what role do electric cars play in all of this?
I mean, they are helping to transform the energy landscape, as well as, you know, as you've seen the success of Tesla. Volvo is announcing that after 2020, they're going all electric, and probably all major car manufacturers coming out with some kind of hybrid or electric car. Everything from the big companies here, GM and Ford, to BMW and Mercedes. But once again, the key is going to be putting in place some form of infrastructure, because you just pointed out to a couple key points. And And that is heat. You know, during the winter, you need to power heat. That takes a lot of battery use. The other thing is distance. I know that often I'll drive over to Arizona to visit family. And as I climb Highway 8, it gets up to about 6,000 feet. I remember one time I was driving and there was a Tesla and you could just see it sort of fade back after a while. So the real problem here is infrastructure, in other words, charging stations, and they're going to have to come up with something, either a fast charge that can get you going to your next location. Because, John, how many people want to travel if you have to sit around, pull into a charge station, and wait around for a half an hour or 45 minutes to charge to go another 100 or 200 miles, however big the charge is? So the infrastructure isn't quite there to get you there, but that is coming. As more and more electric cars are sold, and as the car fleet in the United States changes here and elsewhere, you will see the infrastructure form in place, because this is the trend that we're going in terms of transportation. In fact, China is moving full steam towards building electric car market. By 2040, they're expected to have over 120 million electric cars, almost 40% of the electric cars in the world. The European Union is next, then India, and finally the U.S.
And of course, then you have to ask the question, Jim, if you're going to be charging at these charging stations and you have X million number of cars doing it, that's a tremendous amount of amperage, you know, energy being consumed. With what are you going to generate that? And that turns to the subject of generating plants and how energy is put into the grid. Okay, so how does that translate, though, to, what are we saying, investment and to energy itself?
Well, I mean, electric cars are slowing the pace of global oil demand, and that impact will accelerate going forward as the electric fleet begins to expand here and elsewhere. But in the future, the major demand for oil and energy use will shift from the passenger car, which dominates it today, and that's going to be to trucks, aviation, and shipping and petrochemicals. So if you look at demand, I mean, people don't realize so much of the products that are made from petrochemicals, so many of the materials in your home, from pharmaceuticals to even clothing, comes from a petrochemical base. But, you know, John, I just don't see the day they're going to put a 767 in the air on some kind of wind turbine, or, you know, that's not going to work. Maybe they can do it with a small nuclear power plant inside a plane, but for the foreseeable future, at least for the next two decades, you know, when you're on an airplane, it's going to be powered by carbon fuels. And if you take a look at those big ships at sea, even though the U.S. uses nuclear power in its submarines and its aircraft carriers, a good vast amount of those warships that we have are still powered with diesel fuel, as so much of the transportation industry is. So shipping and aviation are going to be one of the main oil drivers going forward, as well as our U.S. military.
Now we open up a big can of worms here, because as the IEA report indicated, the U.S. is becoming the leader of oil and gas production. This is really affecting what's going on in the Middle East. I don't know if you've seen some of the reports coming out geopolitically, how this is actually playing a role in what may well erupt into warfare in the Middle East. But other than that, what other implications does this have?
Well, according to U.S. trends, the U.S. shifts to becoming a net exporter of gas and oil in the next decade. The bulk of that is going to come from shale oil and gas here. Now, here's a key thing. The U.S. is consuming less energy as a result of fuel efficiency and also fuel switching within the U.S., especially on the industrial and the consumer side. But you've seen the impact of U.S. shale and its impact on OPEC's ability to control the world price of oil. Oil is no longer likely to go to $100 a barrel outside of a war or a major political event within Saudi Arabia. Even though there's still large inventories out there, that inventory storage is beginning to shrink. And that's why, with this latest upheaval with the arrest coming in Saudi Arabia, why we saw oil prices spike. So within Saudi Arabia, you are seeing the impact most visibly in the last 3 years, because OPEC took a gamble. They thought if they drove the price low enough, they would drive a lot of U.S. production out of business. Instead, we got more efficient. We're able to produce shale oil at a lower cost, and we are in the driver's seat. So natural gas is going to play an increasing role in energy consumption, and the U.S. is going to be a major power player in LNG exports, and that's going to be key to watch because so much of the new power plants are being built, as we're seeing overseas, is coming from Asia, and they're building natural gas plants in China and Japan. India is also going in the same direction along with renewables. And right now, the big player in the natural gas market is the U.S. and the Middle East, but the U.S. is moving into that third slot.
And how does this all flow into implications for energy companies, I guess both big and small?
Well, when you're looking at energy companies, it's important you look at natural gas production as part of their reserves. The main importers of natural gas are going to be Asia and Europe, with Asia becoming the biggest international market. So companies that have global reach and infrastructure that can service and provide that supply, these markets will become the big beneficiaries going forward.
You know, in all of this, I'm a big fan of new technologies that will provide us with sustainable, clean, renewable energy, as long as it's based on some really sound science. But we see that that's going to do that in the future. It'll reduce the amount of carbon emissions, especially pollution. Pollution is where we notice it immediately. Carbon emissions tangled up with anthropogenic global warming as well. So how would we sum all of this up if we took a snapshot of where we are and where we think it's all heading?
Well, if you take a look at the conclusions from this mammoth report, number one, the oil and gas boom in the U.S. is shaking up the established order. We've seen that in the last 3 years with major implications for markets, trade flows, investment, and energy security. One of the main reasons our trade deficit has fallen over the last 3 or 4 years is the production of energy. We're importing less. Number two, the versatility of natural gas means it is well placed to grow, but it cannot afford price spikes or uncertainty. And that's one of the issues that they still have to deal with this kind of market, because we've seen, like oil, natural gas can spike and it can also drop precipitously. Number three, China continues to shape global trends, especially on the renewable front, in new ways with their energy revolution. Number four, the strategy for sustainable energy shows that concerted action to address climate change is fully compatible with global goals for access to air quality, and electrification and digitization are the future for many parts of the global energy system, creating new opportunities, but also risks the policymakers have to address. Part of that is going to be solved with technology. But once again, this is going to reshape the investment markets. And a lot of the big energy companies, I'm talking about the big international oil companies, are ideally positioned for this new kind of market. Many of them have made major acquisitions on the natural gas front. They're also making acquisitions in terms of LNG export facilities, and that's going to be a big role. Some of the big guys are already moving heavily into Asia because they recognize that's where the future of energy consumption lies.
And what that really means is right now we're in a transition period. But as you and I have said for a long time here on the show, despite all of the debate over global warming, natural gas and oil are not going anywhere in the near future, because up until this moment, there was nothing readily available to replace it. And that will transition over time, but that's over time. And that's what that means. And of course, there are all sorts of investment implications for that.
And, you know, once again, even though we may be driving electric cars maybe 10 years from now, and that's the predominant form of transportation, maybe even driverless cars, ships and planes still burn diesel fuel.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
There's a massive global race underway to achieve exascale and quantum computing supremacy. And it's taking place in laboratories around the world, Santa Barbara, Oxford, Moscow, Zurich, Haifa, China. And the U.S. has traditionally led this race, investing about $200 million a year. The Department of Energy recently said that they would award $258 million to produce an exascale supercomputer with quantum processors. But other countries are making even larger investments.
Well, the real estate market has been having another good year. Will it continue into the future? And how will tax reform impact the real estate industry? The good news is housing prices are rising. Joining me on the program is Frank Nothoff. He is executive and chief economist at CoreLogic. And Frank, let's talk about the real estate market. You believe it'll be up 5% this year or more and could possibly rise another 5% next year. What is driving that?
What's driving it is a very low inventory of homes available on the market for sale, the continuation of very low mortgage rates, and the fact that the economy has gotten better. A lot of jobs have been created. The unemployment rate's been pushed all the way down to 4.1%. And those are all good ingredients for stimulating demand. And if you have more demand to buy homes with kind of a restricted supply of homes available for sale, that translates into house price growth.
So as the economy is improving, I think in one of your broadcasts that you talk about, there's still, what is it, roughly a little over 5% of the country that is still underwater. Is that mainly in the Rust Belt or depressed areas of the economy?
It's in pockets of the country, for sure. That's where we see still some concentration. But there's usually a few underwater homes just about everywhere in the country. Where we see the concentration still today are those markets that had a very steep decline in home values during the housing crash and the Great Recession. And even though house prices have bounced back, in some of these markets, they have not bounced back as far as where they had been prior to the crash. And that's why so many homeowners are still underwater. I'll give you an example of a couple of markets like that. For example, Las Vegas. Las Vegas saw house prices fall about 70% from their peak in 2006. And even though house prices today are up about 40-50% in Las Vegas from the trough, the fact that they had fallen so far down, there are still a lot of homeowners in Las Vegas that are underwater. And that's true also in parts of Florida, too. In parts of Florida, house prices crashed 50% or more. And even though prices are up substantially from the trough over the last 5 years, there's still many neighborhoods where prices have yet to recover.
Let's talk about some of those areas that are doing very well. And I want to talk about if you see any bubble-like areas in the country. And what comes to mind, Frank, is our own state of California, where the median price in San Francisco, I think, is like almost $1.4 million.
Oh, yeah, prices have gone up and are very high in San Francisco. But, you know, as you know, Jim, that happens periodically, especially in San Francisco. It's a very popular location to live, beautiful scenery, the weather is good, and yet there's not a lot of new construction, not a lot of new supply, partly because of the constraints with the Big Bay and the ocean and some of the mountain ranges. So that restricts the construction of new dwellings, that limits it, and yet there's increasing demand for homes in that marketplace. So you're absolutely right. The median price of a new home to buy a home in San Francisco is over $1 million. But San Francisco historically has been a very high-cost market. So even if we look back 20 years ago or 40 years ago, San Francisco was a high-cost market back then. It continues to be a high-cost market today, and I'm pretty certain it's going to be a high-cost market 10, 20 years from now.
You know, Frank, let's talk about what has made this housing cycle a little bit different. Number one, we're looking at probably the lowest mortgage rates that we've seen in decades, and they're real this time, not like the kind of phony loans that they had in the real estate bubble. But the other thing that has made it different is, at least I've seen, home builders have been reluctant to build large swaths of spec homes. They've been very circumspect in what they build. And the other thing is that, you know, getting workers, because so many were displaced during the downturn. You know, I don't know what it's like in elsewhere around the country, but here in California, it's hard getting workers to do things because there's a shortage of them.
Well, you know, when I speak to my colleagues who are home builders, I hear the same refrain. It's the three L's. It's labor, land, and lending. And you've hit on a couple of them. So one is labor, and when we had the big crash in home building, a lot of the workers either moved to other jobs in other industries or they left the country. They went down south of the border. And it's been a real challenge for home builders to get enough labor with the right skills in order to come in and meet the demand for new homes. In fact, in the latest data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the percentage of unfilled job openings in the construction sector, it's the highest it's been in 17 years. And that just underscores the challenges that builders are having identifying and locating the labor that they need to build homes. Now, some of it is the labor moved out of the country or moved to different jobs. Another challenge on the labor side, sadly enough, is the opiate crisis that we do have in the U.S. And there are many prospective job seekers who come to a work site, but they fail the drug test. And, you know, for a lot of the jobs at a construction site and building homes, you need to have workers who are present, not just physically, but present mentally as well. So that has been an issue. But it's not just labor. I mentioned land and lending. On the land side, builders are finding that it's just very difficult to find the quality lots, especially large parcels that they can subdivide and build a new development on. Sometimes it has to do with local jurisdictions and the permitting process, the upfront fees that have to be paid, which all just add to the cost of construction and increases the amount of time to get the necessary permits and maybe even limits how much density can be built. And the third thing is lending. Oftentimes, especially for small local lenders or regional lenders, they have a relationship with a local bank. And this is so true with a local builder. They have a relationship with a local community bank, and yet some of the new rules and regulations that the small local banks face limit the amount of credit they can extend to one builder, to one borrower. And that limits how quickly that builder can develop and build out properties. So it's really a confluence of events, labor, land, and lending all working together to slow the pace of construction recovery.
I want to talk about something that's on front burner politically in Washington, and that is tax reform. A couple things that have come up. One is the limitation on property tax deductions on the House plan, zero in the Senate, and also the limitation of mortgage interest expense deduction to $500,000. Frank, do you think that will have an impact on housing? And if so, in which way?
I think it will have an impact on housing, and it'll be an impact that'll be larger in high-cost markets. And you mentioned California, especially the San Francisco Bay Area earlier. That would be a market that could be potentially impacted further because of the elimination of certain deductions or cap on how much you can deduct as a homeowner. But it's not just San Francisco or the California coast. It's all the way up the Pacific coast to Seattle as well, another high-cost market. And in the Northeast, where property tax rates and home prices are also tend to be high. Boston, New York City, all the way down to Washington, D.C., are other high-cost markets. So it will have some effect. The limitation or the extra requirements around the capital gains exclusion would require, in the bills that have been presented, would require an owner to have lived in the home 5 of the last 8 years, as opposed to current law, which is 2 out of 5 years. And I think that's going to have an important impact on the decision that many homeowners have on whether or not they're going to put their home on the market. It's likely it'll incent homeowners to stay in the house that they are in longer. That means over time, there is a smaller number of existing homes that will be put on the market for sale. And as you know, in so many markets right now, the inventory of homes for sale is already very tight. Supply is limited. And so that provision could actually exacerbate the for sale inventory issue going forward where we'll see homeowners choose to stay in their home longer than they would have previously and limit the number of existing homes that come on the market for sale.
That was something that has not come out in the press, that they would limit the time for capital gains on the sale of home. Did they do anything with the capital gain exclusion of $250,000 for single, $500,000 for married? Did they leave that alone?
Well, I believe those amounts are still in there, but you have to have lived in the home as your principal residence in the bill 5 of the last 8 years, as opposed to current law, which is just 2 out of the last 5 years. So that is an important change.
Wow. So as you look at this, I want to talk about another topic, and that is new household formations, because we've seen with the millennials, a lot of them are straddled with debt, student loans. I think I read somewhere the average is somewhere around $35,000. So the average millennial couple starts off life with $70,000 to $100,000 in debt. So a lot of them are migrating, and they are less apt to, let's say, get into the housing market. Do you see that demographic changing as they mature, get older, and move up in their careers?
Well, I do. I've looked at a lot of surveys of attitudes toward housing and home ownership that have been conducted over the last few years. And I'll tell you my takeaway from reviewing these survey results. Millennials have the same desire for home ownership as their parents had. But they have the recognition that it may take them longer to attain home ownership than with their parents. And I think that is a big change. And you mentioned student debt. That is a big difference between millennials and what their parents went through many years ago. The total amount of student debt outstanding in the United States today is $1.4 trillion. And as you mentioned, you know, the typical loan is about $35,000. So millennials have that additional debt, and as they work in the labor market, they'll, over time, advance in their careers and earn a somewhat higher income, and that gives them then hopefully, the ability to service the student debt, that is, consistently make their monthly payments that are due under student loans, and also have enough left over to save for the down payment and be able to manage the mortgage payment. Now, the group of millennials I'm most concerned about are those who started college, took out student debt, but never finished. And that's really a population that may have the greatest difficulty migrating into home ownership because they've added student debt, but they haven't received the benefits that typically come with a college or graduate school education, namely the prospects for a higher paying job. So they end up with a lower paying job, and yet they've taken on all this debt. And for that segment, it may be very difficult to transition into home ownership.
You know, Frank, what about another segment of housing? And let's talk about the demographics of the country, which is aging baby boomers. What about retirement homes, or let's say retirement developments? For example, like what comes to mind is Del Webb, which has a lot of retirement developments in the Southwest. You know, I'm thinking of Phoenix and Nevada and places like that.
Certainly the leading age of the baby boom cohort now is in their early 70s, 71 years of age, going to be 72 next year. And the largest group of baby boomers, if we look at it by single year of age, are the ones who are about 59, 60 years of age. There's actually more of them than there are of the older baby boomers or the slightly younger baby boomers. And for that middle group, which again is the largest in number, those aged in the late 50s up to age 60, many of them are still working. They've put down roots in their neighborhood, their community. They haven't retired yet. Some have. I know some have, but not all of them. Mostly they're still in the labor market. And they may have an eye toward retiring in the next few years, and some may even have purchased a second home. But many are going to stay put where they are for the next several years because they're not ready to make that transition. Now, again, the older, the initial wave of baby boomers, those are the ones who are 71, 72 years of age, they may be now at the point where they're looking to maybe move into a 55-plus community with a lot of amenities. and perhaps if they live up north, perhaps move down south so they don't have to deal with snow and ice on a regular basis. So I think that's going to be a really growing segment of demand.
You know, something that we're seeing here in some of the bigger cities like San Diego, even in San Francisco, you're seeing a revitalization of the downtown area. In San Diego, they are putting up high-rise condominiums all over the place. It's almost like every 3 or 4 months, they're putting up another building. What about those kind of developments? Do you see that as a trend, not only in just San Diego, but other areas around coastal areas?
The return to the center city, it's been one of the most fascinating trends of the last decade. And I think in part, it does have to do with the millennial cohort. You know, they've wanted to be back in the city. They want to be where the action is. And you mentioned San Diego, LA, San Francisco. We see it as well throughout the country. We see it on the East Coast, a strong revitalization in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. But we see it also in the midsection of the country, a bit of a renaissance in Cleveland, and even down south in Dallas and San Antonio and Houston. And it's not just in the suburban communities. It's really in the urban core, the central city. And I think it's the millennials looking for, you know, the excitement and the amenities that generally come with being in a denser area, a lot more nightlife, and a lot more opportunity to socialize as well. The millennial cohort is a very interesting one. And as you know, they are larger in number than the baby boom cohort. And if you looked at the millennial cohort by single year of age, the largest group of millennials are those in the U.S. aged 27 right now. That's the age of the largest group of millennials. And that's a time when, you know, typically you're out of school, you've started your career, you've been working, hopefully, a few years. But you may not yet be ready to marry and settle down necessarily. Many have, but not all. And perhaps not ready yet for home ownership. Usually often the pattern is first you settle down, you get married, and maybe the trigger that leads you to buy a home is the fact that you start having kids or you expect to have kids. And for many of the millennials, and again, the largest number by single year of age are 27-year-olds today, many of them have not taken those steps yet. But I do think that they will over the next few years.
So, Frank, as we conclude here, as you look at real estate, you believe that prices could rise another 5% next year. We do have two things that could impact the market. One would be tax reform, which would limit deductibility of whether it's property taxes, mortgage deductions, or the ability to, let's say, move in and out of a house. And then, of course, the other thing is the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates. So you have two forces there. Is it possible that the combination of these two over a period of time could put housing back into recession, or is there enough demand to keep the market going?
There's ample demand for affordably priced homes, but that's the real challenge. That's also where we have the shortest supply. In my view, there's ample supply of expensive homes, whether they're to buy or to rent. When we do look at the new construction over the last few years, on the single family side, it tends to be expensive homes with a lot of amenities, a lot of living space. And on the multifamily rental construction, it also tends to be projects with a lot of amenities, health and fitness center, spacious rooms, good views. So there's been ample supply coming in both for purchase and for rent of homes with a lot of amenities, more expensive. We haven't seen that for the more affordably priced homes. And I think that's really the crunch. That's the challenge that we have in society, because there's going to be increasing demand for affordably priced homes. I was looking at the latest consumer price index for the United States, and over the 12 months ending October, the overall consumer price index was up 2% on a year-over-year basis. But in that report, they also break out the various components. One-third of the consumer price index is made up of shelter. And the biggest component of shelter cost is rent. And rent for residential apartments in the U.S. over the same 12-month period was up 3.7%. So nearly double the overall consumer price index. And in the consumer price index, you can net out shelter and then look at the other components. And it's interesting, when I did that, I saw that the consumer price index, taking shelter out and just looking at all the other goods and services that consumers buy, that price index, that inflation rate was only 1.4% over the last 12 months. So 1.4% growth in cost or prices for consumers for everything other than shelter, 3.7% increase in rent on residential homes, which then, when you put it all together, translates into the 2% rise in the consumer price index. So it's quite clear that housing, whether you're looking to buy a home or looking to rent a home, is increasingly more expensive. Prices for homes or for renting apartments is rising much more rapidly than prices for other goods that consumers buy.
Well, Frank, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, I know you have a blog and you also put out short video snippets that update people on the real estate market and the different property markets around the country. How can they find you?
They can find us at www.corelogic.com, and we have blogs and publications that we post under the Insights tab of our website. And you can always, once you get to CoreLogic.com, you could go to the search window and put in either blogs or put in my name. And that would be perhaps the quickest way to get to some of the material that we post.
And the spelling of that name is N-O-T-H-A-F-T. Well, Frank, so glad to have you on the program. You put out a lot of great work. It's great to be in touch, and come back and see us again.
And thanks so much for having me on the show, Jim. I really enjoyed it.
Jim, here we are coming up on Thanksgiving weekend. Wish everybody in the United States a very happy Thanksgiving when it comes later on in the onrushing week. And we do know that the tax reform bill is going to be batted back and forth, and finally we'll come out with a final version and see how that affects everything and everyone. I guess the markets are going to be the examination coming up through the rest of the year as we approach December.
The real big thing here is really going to be tax reform. They were unable to repeal Obamacare, and the market has been going up in anticipation of these lower tax rates and what it might mean for profits. So you've got a lot of things going on here, and a lot of it depends on it. I mean, look at it this way. If you're paying taxes at a 35% tax rate and it drops down to 20, what does that mean? Higher profits. So this, John, could go either way. It passed the House, but it's having trouble already in the Senate, where the Republicans only have a 2-seat majority. And already one senator says, well, he wasn't for it, but he could be changed. And there's 3 or 4 others that are sitting on the fence. So this is really the big thing heading into the end of the year. And of course, the widely anticipated Fed rate hike, which comes next month, that will move short-term rates up. And also, it's going to raise borrowing costs. All of that, we'll be here to talk about it. And of course, the upcoming holiday season. Will online retail once again trump brick and mortar, which is widely expected? In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend. And of course, a happy Thanksgiving.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.